Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes where a range of interesting people come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. This week, we're delighted to say hello to Old City Records' Olin O'Brien. Olin was a Banter guest in our very early days and he was great value, but we never recorded that one, so it was great to make amends at the Sure Shots Festival in the Model in Sligo a few weeks ago. A great conversation about running a record shop, operating a record label, the state of hip-hop today, and many other matters. Hi folks, hope you're well. Welcome back to the final banter here at Sure Shots for the weekend. It's been a pretty amazing adventure. It's the first time we've ever done this shit. This is a Facebook Live shit. This is amazing. This is like, there's people on the west coast of America, Olin, right now waking up and watching us, you know. Shout out to B+, you know, who's definitely watching this. So, likely. I'm joined by someone who's spoken at Banter before.
Years ago.
You were one of the first people to speak at Banter. You were one of the OGs. This is Olin O'Brien. He runs the Old City Record Shop and the Old City Label based in Dublin, Ireland. So, pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Jim.
How was yesterday for you? Yesterday being Record Store Day.
We were saying before we came on, it's a bit embarrassing, really, the whole Record Store Day.
What do you mean by embarrassing?
As a celebration of self, you're not really allowed to do that. I think there's a whole kind of, there's a little industry built up around it now. And I know it's easy to blame the major labels, but it's not really them. It's probably as much the shops themselves. Kind of like, you get the beg and bowl out kind of thing.
I think as well, it's almost like you kind of said when you were talking earlier on, I mean, there's still record shops around. You don't need this kind of like save the record shop day once a year.
No, I think it's probably run its course. I think it's like we have a good day. We always have a really good day and it's a great laugh. But like I kind of make it explicitly about people who come into the shop and try and keep the promo of it kind of low key because it's just like, I mean, it's not like we have a kind of tip jar there that you're supposed to throw the money in. You know, it's either you come into the shop, it's cool. If you want to spend some money, that's cool. But we don't need a charity donation and we're not doing anything other than selling product. Right. Do you know, like we're following a charity talk. So it's kind of a bit ridiculous that, you know, at least they're like performing some function. Vinyl, we definitely got too head up on the medium of vinyl. It's just getting ridiculous.
It's totally ridiculous. We had Alan Sims from kind of Shine yesterday, and he was telling us that he's got rid of his entire vinyl collection.
Right, okay.
This is someone who's DJed for 20 years plus, just got rid of everything. Just take the shit away. He doesn't want it anymore. Got rid of it.
I think there's kind of different types of people. Like when I was first going to the States, not first, but when I was first kind of buying big collections over there, say in about 10 years ago, a lot of people were getting rid of their records, so it's easy to pick the stuff up. And that's what makes them kind of forward thinking. They're like, look, why use records? They you don't need them anymore. Their function is gone. You can use the MP3 for the same thing. So there's always kind of people who are probably ahead of the curve and say, well, I don't need a record because I have the file. It does the same thing. But then there's a reason you get attracted to them because they are very addictive things. There's something about the things that, like, I've definitely cut down my collection and I've definitely seen and been around enough collectors to know I don't want to be a collector. And I'm not talking about someone who spends 50 quid on records. I'm talking about someone who is obsessive, you know, eats, sleeps, and drinks the things, and someone who will do like very underhand things to get records. Like I've met real collectors that...
What kind of underhand things?
Well, like just the way, you know, I remember there's a dealer I know in LA and the kind of bitching that would go on in their kind of record dealing community about, you know, going behind people's backs to get records and kind of robbing old grannies of their record collections, you know, that kind of stuff. When you get into the A-League of record collecting, you're like, it's a manufactured item. It's a bit ridiculous. You know, it is a bit ridiculous that people do go so crazy for collecting them. And the thing about it is, as well, you're never satisfied when you're collecting. You never can complete that collection. So it's not something you want to go too far down the rabbit hole with, you know, because there's, you know, you just tick the thing off and then there's a million other things in the wants list and stuff. But going back to the kind of record store day thing, I think, like, I noticed this year in Dublin, there's a couple of people who are involved with this record store day. And I don't know who they work for or what sort of shady organization it is, but I got these emails and they popped into the shop. Very nice people, but I was kind of like, what's going on here? Like, what's this all about? You know, and they're like telling you how to kind of, you know, do this and join this Facebook group and all. And it's just a bit, it's a bit embarrassing. It's okay, just
so let's go back to a time before Record Store Day ever started. So you set up All City in 2001. What were you doing before 2001?
What was I doing? I was a computer programmer for a while. So I wasn't too long out of college. So I was a computer programmer, which I did for a few years, and I set it up with another guy, Dave Smith. Yeah, Splice, who. He was, at the time, he was a bit younger, and he ended up teaching music for a bit and then going off to Japan, and then I just kind of took it on myself.
Like, I mean, a computer programmer, you know, I mean, that was kind of like...
Well, I wasn't very good at it. I mean, remember 2001, it was easy to get a job.
Who were you working for?
I was a contractor. I did a few, worked for some small companies, some big ones, yeah. Like, I genuinely not being... modest, I was pretty crap.
Okay,
well, it probably is very easy to still get. I could probably go back to it. I imagine it's very easy to get a tech job in Dublin.
Yeah, like there's always people looking for coders and developers.
Yeah,
you know?
I'd imagine.
Okay,
so,
when All City came along, I mean, what was this, like, you know, the impetus behind it? I mean, why did you set it up? I mean,
because
you were a big hip hop fan, right?
We were record heads, you know, kind of like record heads, kind of hip hop and the roots of hip hop, you know, funk, soul, reggae, disco, all that
the real
kind of
old
thing.
School.
Yeah. And hip-hop was kind of coming to an end. You could feel it in 2001. The art form was not very progressive or interesting. So I feel we just wanted to set up All City for a couple of years and get loads of records. That was really the thing. And then it kind of took on a life of its own. But, I mean, there was no massive plan behind it or whatever. You know, it was just...
I mean, it took on a life of its own, like, I mean, when you started releasing records, and particularly when, like, I mean, you started working with Heralds of Change.
That was probably the little, what would you say, catalyst, maybe? Yeah, because, you know, we'd put out five. Five kind of Irish hip-hop things. First one was Re-Raw, which... is actually going to be licensed to this Tramp Records, their German kind of archival label, and they were on to me during the week looking to license that. So
what was that? Was that 25 in the morning?
Interesting. Yeah, 25 o'clock in the morning. So that Adrian Sherwood and Re-Raw, I'm not sure what Sherwood's role was in it, but so that was a good kickoff. But essentially, it wasn't like we wanted to do that music. We just knew we had a few records that were worth putting out, and then it was kind of like, oh... you know, what do we do now kind of thing. I think when you're from Ireland, there's very little professional music industry people. So I didn't really understand what a record label was or does or how they make money and stuff. I'm only kind of figuring out now because it's not like, you know, when I go to the States or when you go to England and you look through records, you can see that there's an industry that's been in existence since the 50s and 60s. And we don't have that. So it was only after doing a few and the Heralds of Change coming along, which was Mike Slott and Hudson Mohawk, that you're like, oh, actually, and people start to contact you off the back of that and say, oh, you need to do this, and we want to license that, and you need to register this, and you're like, oh, okay, there's a, you know, you understand it's what a record label is. It's essentially, it's just there to put music onto a mechanical form, whether that's a record, a CD, or now digitally, and then kind of exploit it, really. Yeah. So, you know, the grubby kind of, like, how do we make money out of someone else's... I don't even want to call it art, because the vast majority of music is probably not high art, but, like, it's a commercial thing. So you kind of see, all right, okay, this is a very kind of... it's a very commercial process, I guess. Okay. You know.
Let's talk a little bit then about the Heralds of Change, like your own, because I mean that was Mike Slot, who's a Dubliner, right?
Yeah.
And he was over in Glasgow and he hooked up with this kid Ross.
Yeah.
Like Hudson Mohawk.
Yeah.
I mean Hudson was Ross was a kid. He was 18, was he at the time?
Let me see. He's I don't want to say his birth year. 2006. Well, 2005 we put the first record out, was it? No, 2005 I met him, so he would have been, I don't think he would have been old enough to buy a drink at that stage.
Jesus, okay, yeah. I remember you saying to me, like, maybe the demos he was doing at that stage, the Hudson Mohawk demos, they were, like, off
Hudson,
the charts.
Hudson Heaters, yeah, absolutely brilliant. He should actually put that out. I think it would be really good release. Like it was a killer little demo. I remember getting it and just going, holy fuck, it was next level. I mean, I don't know enough about the music making process to know what exactly he was doing, but you can spot when someone just has it in them, you know what I mean? Just that little bit of quirkiness that you're kind of like, whoa, how did he have it in him so young? And it's funny because it doesn't really give you a guide of where they're going to go or anything. It's just like, as a stamp, it was an incredible kind of CD. So I handed it around to a couple of people that I knew in the UK who were all sniffing around them. Not to sell it to them or anything, because in some ways I was like, already this guy's way too big for me. It was pretty obvious. Then you kind of saw the whole kind of thing in motion, the big labels and how they work. And I guess when I saw that, I kind of saw what you can do and what you can't do being in Dublin, you know. So when I saw that, you know, Warp could kind of come in, take him, and basically, not in a bad way, you know, and, you know, map his career out and enable him to make a good living. And not only make a good living, actually hook up with people that were on his level across the planet, you know, you're kind of like, well, I can't do that for him. So it wasn't a big gripe or anything. But I did kind of go, all right, I could probably have helped him along for another year or two, maybe. Yeah, okay.
After Heralds of Change, then, I mean, the artist kind of like they got more profile for the label. Was that Onra?
Yeah, I suppose Onra and Knowledge in and around the same time. Onra was a part of this kind of MySpace thing. So that was a great way to kind of, I suppose, when after seeing with Mike and Ross and not really being that interested in the vocal side of hip-hop or anything anymore.
I mean, you'd given up at hip-hop at that stage.
I remember
you and me meeting one night in the Twisted Pepper, and you were like, I remember you were spitting fury about hip-hop. It was quite animated.
Maybe I was still drinking then, I don't know, but I definitely think that as an art form at that stage, it's just a commercial popular music. There's nothing wrong with that, but I felt that the innovation in the music had kind of gone. You know, when even I was looking at something recently, a David Toop thing, and it's mad to think that, like, you could kind of intellectualize about hip hop. I don't really feel you can do that anymore. I don't think there's certain
kind of players you can do. I suppose people are doing it with the Kendrick album at the moment.
I think that's a different thing, because people will go, oh, like, he's an interesting character, but if you actually listen to the music, you know, it's not really like, it's for me anyway. I wouldn't really like, I'd listen to it at once and then I'd kind of be like, okay, I wouldn't.
But
really.
When you mentioned their Toop and, like, you know, the way people looked at hip hop back in the day compared to what happened, I mean, you know, when we kind of, like, I suppose we're still in the middle of it, so, but like, when you eventually kind of scope out of it and look back into what happened in late 90s, early 2000s, you're right, I mean, hip hop just disappeared over its arse.
Well, it became rap, I suppose, so it became easy to, you need a kind of figurehead around things, and once you have a vocalist, it becomes about the vocalist and it detracts from everything else. And also once you bring in the LP, once you bring in the kind of album format, you make the music less inventive. So you can kind of see it probably happening in house and techno as well now, because you got to formalize the music around a kind of 10 to 12 track album, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it definitely will mean that innovation is probably on the 12 inch really, or the 7 inch.
Yeah. Go back to Onra then. Go back to him.
So Onra, we hooked up with him through MySpace, which I mean, just it seems like it didn't even exist, MySpace, isn't it? So.
Yeah, but like, you know, when you look at MySpace, I mean, MySpace was perfect for music.
Yeah, it was great.
It was great, and like, I think we'll see a nostalgic yearning from many music makers for that kind of community that MySpace was.
Yeah,
about.
It was brilliant. I mean, it was like it had your little inbox and a search facility, able to contact people. I mean, a lot of people got back.
Let's start the MySpace revival right now, you and me.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I got an email the other week, like, going, such and such is now your friend on MySpace. I was like, what? Just some random... I wondered, are they doing that to people? But I can't see... It's still there, but I can't believe that anyone actually uses
someone, like,
it.
It was
probably
sold.
It
was sold.
Something,
Tom, that fucking idiot, yeah. He sold it to Murdoch and made loads of money from that. And then eventually it was kind of sold in a fire sale. Justin Timberlake was involved at some stage.
I think he still is.
Shout out to Justin Timberlake. Justin Timberlake was involved at some stage, but fuck knows what it is now, you know?
It's probably a dating site, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, Tinder for musicians. Anyway, you found on Tinder.
Yeah, MySpace. So you had that like kind of top 8 friends, and then you could expand it to top 16. Yeah. So he, I don't know how I came across him. Actually, if I was recommended to him, but he was after making a record at the time called The Big Payback with a musician from Alabama who's starting to make some noise now, Byron the Aquarius. He's on Sound Signature and stuff. So. I'm not sure how they hooked up, but I'd imagine it was MySpace.
I mean, that was a good while ago.
Yeah, it's over 10 years ago, maybe 2000.
So Byron was kicking back then.
Yeah, it was, yeah. No, it's been a long road for him, actually.
Okay, so on them kind of like me and gave you some material, and you've kind of released 3 China Series albums so far?
No, two. I didn't do the first one, so we did the second one and the most recent one, and then we boxed them up, and I think that's the end of it.
Yeah. It's very funny. There was a thing in Dublin about a month and a half ago called Socialize. That Richard Seabrook put on, and I can't remember the designer. Is it Declan?
Donald.
Yeah, I heard about this. He told the story of the armor design.
Yeah, jeez.
He was basically. I think he's going to have to get therapy after it.
Yeah, honor is a tough taskmaster. And this is the good thing, and this goes back to the Ross thing as well. Like because. When you're Irish, you're used to being half-arsed about things, and we've managed to put it into like a trait that everyone must think we're great, you know, like because we're half-arsed at things. But it's been really good working with foreign people and seeing how they do things and that they don't take this half-arsed stuff. You know, so with Honra, like, I was a kind of mediator between Honra and Donald, and Honra's been very good to Donald. And Donald's done a great job, but like...
He's done great work on it.
It's definitely cultural differences of like, listen, when's this going to get done, you know, and like, it's grand isn't kind of a good enough answer. So it's been, we got there in the end, but I guess the problem is a wider one in the music thing of like, Donal or me and Honor probably just about, it's very tough to make a living solely doing that, so you do have to kind of structure it around other things. So you're kind of asking someone to do artwork for a proper project that's going to do quite well, but they're not, it's not their full-time gig.
Yeah, I mean that kind of brings us kind of label economics. And like I remember interviewing you in 2010 or 2011, and you were kind of like me saying, you know, you were doing well in terms of releases. You would sell 1,000, 1,500 in a run, but like the money that was coming, the thing that was kind of keeping things going was digital.
Well, I mean, it still
digital
is. Downside, yeah.
It still is. Yeah. Is it despite streaming and everything? You still kind of making cash off downloads?
I'm really. It's another one. It's another kind of weird thing you hear. I mean, streaming. You probably use it a lot.
Yeah, I use it a lot. I know as well from kind of like talking to record labels, both majors and independents, that it's become a serious source of revenue for them.
It's huge money.
They're all kind of, the one thing, sorry to cut across you, but what they're all kind of saying is that it's quite boring. It's a bit like the spreadsheets, and they become data analysts going back to your earlier games.
Yeah, you do.
You know, there's no crack to it.
I don't know who I was talking to about this. It definitely wasn't you, or maybe it was Sunil. Like a huge part of it now is going through the spreadsheets to kind of see how much money you owe someone from all these like millions of Spotify plays. But I don't know where this idea came that you don't get money from streaming. It's absolutely nonsense.
Like, you know, you're not kind of chasing people for the money. The money is coming to you.
If you don't get money for streaming if people aren't streaming your stuff. Otherwise, you do, and there's a lot of money there. I mean, for the top people, it must be insane. I mean, it must be insane for Kendrick, for you two.
Like, I think they're Ed Sheeran right now. He probably he probably should kind of like get the money out and kind of like banknotes and just take a bath in them, you know?
Yeah. Well, what it does though, it kind of removes the need for labels. Labels are now kind of like project managers, I think. You know, that's kind of what they are. Maybe there's a curatorial aspect to it, maybe. But really, you'd have a management team around it now, and essentially, there must be no need for a label at that level, other than to, because if you don't even need to P&D your stuff, if you can just put it out for free, there's no real need.
Well, at the same time, we talked before we started about like that vinyl bounce, and in your case, you're still kind of like, you're still got P&Ds going on, you're still involved in kind of shipping problems.
Yeah, love it. I love records, and it's great that there is a record bounce, because it feeds everything, like the actual physical. Like I say, there's something about records that is just inherently addictive. You know, they people just get very addicted to them. And what I've seen with this bounce is all these kids coming in, and I never thought this would happen, because I thought if you weren't buying records as a kid, you would not have that attraction to them. Like that, I still, like, what, before I was waiting for you, I was texting someone about a Discogs thing. I mean, I'm not a heavy collector, but I'm still kind of going, I need that record. And I've no idea why, because it just it's in you once. And I didn't think it would happen to this generation of kids, but it seems to be. So that does feed into everything, and it feeds into kind of all the labels and the buzz around music. And I think that's a good thing. But I guess maybe labels and maybe musicians, maybe they were spoiled in the past, and maybe some people are just going to have to accept that music isn't going to be a full-time gig. You know,
that's hard for musicians to accept as well. You know what I mean? Because like a lot of them are kind of like brought up on a dream. You know, they brought up this dream that like if they're a band, for example, that someone's going to show up in a chauffeur-driven limousine outside and kind of go, "Hey, you guys, I'm going to sign you, and make you rich, and turn you into coke addicts." Yeah. You know, I mean, that's their dream. So like, I mean. But at the same time, there's probably a lot of musicians that we don't actually know who are making a decent enough living.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's that kind of, like, there's a lot of musicians who will be making money from like that kind of chicken and chips DJ circuit, you know, of like, you know, getting a Ryanair to some European city, DJing for 90 minutes.
Two words, Declan Lennon.
Yeah. There you go. You know, and it's weird that has become this model of like electronic music. I think it's a horrible model, but actually there's a lot of money in it. You can probably only do it for a few years. I'm sure it takes it out of you, but you could probably, you know, if you're clever, like someone like Deck is very clever, maybe you can, you know, nearly pay for your house after a few years of it. I don't know. There is a massive amount of money in music, but there's some myth that there isn't. It's just a very, very capitalist system that the people at the top seem to get most of it. And it filters down to a kind of a 1% insecure middle class then underneath it, who they're getting paid, but there's no security of tenure there.
Yeah. But like it's also kind of like, I mean, you've almost got a caste system, you know, that like, I mean, you've got the very, very rich artists, the likes of the Kendricks, the Ed Sheerans and people like that, and all the focus is on them, you know. And then you've kind of like, I mean, you've got the kind of the struggling musician who complains about Spotify all the time. But there's that middle class of people.
Yeah.
And they're doing okay.
They are doing okay, definitely. Like I've had people who just parrot this stuff, "Oh, it's tough for musicians now," and I'm like, well, what musicians are, you know? Like, it's a tough life because you cannot, like, if you go to college for 3 years to become a computer programmer, you're probably going to become a computer programmer. But like, it's, a musician is a tough life because you might give it your best and you might make it. But if you are on the ladder, it's probably okay. There's a lot worse things you could be doing. But the problem I feel is that the actual music then must be very, very difficult to do, because that's not where you make the money really. You make it in and the things in and around, yeah, in and around that. But
it's interesting, kind of, I mean, like a point you got there, because I mean, like, we're in a situation right now where people are looking around the jobs they do, be it computer programming, yeah, or accounting, and they're looking, thinking about automation, yeah, thinking robots are going to take over. And a lot of people are kind of pointing out that the people who survive all this are artists, because they're used to ducking and diving and being creative, mm, you know. And like, you know, people go about making music and being an artist is kind of a precarious habit, yeah, but Jesus, you know, in 5 years' time, being an accountant is going to be like an outdated moment.
Yeah, well, they're turning everyone into that, and that's difficult though, because, not, you know, to go back to Dex's thing, I just saw he's going on about, oh, there's all these mental health issues, and I guess humans aren't probably built to be, some are, but maybe most humans aren't built to kind of deal without that safety, yeah, net. Maybe I don't know. That's a deeper.
I agree there. You know, I mean, mental health issues is something that's kind of been huge, not just in music, but I find it fascinating and really, actually, really invigorating that people are talking more openly about that. Be it like Dec, mm, or be it like Prince William, which is the first time, yeah, Dec Lennon and Crystal Clear and Prince William have been in the same sentence ever. You know.
Yeah, maybe I'm a bit older, so I kind of feel like I'm always like, just bottle it up and say no.
Ah, come on now. Okay, let's go back to something there. You mentioned there, like, me, that you're kind of surprised that kids are coming into the shop and buying records.
Yeah.
Back in 2010, I remember we having this conversation, mm, that, and back then kids would come into the shop and they were buying cans of paint.
They still are. Like, I mean, it's a community based shop that does lots of different things. I think I don't know what I told you the figures were broadly there. Maybe it was 80-20 or something. Maybe it's 60-40, or it could be 50-50 now.
60-40 in favour of
paint, probably.
Oh, yeah.
But that's because records are, there's no money or no margin in them. And I know we were saying before we came on about them being really expensive, and they are. New records are way too expensive. But actually, if you put your accountant's hat on, you'd be like, oh, they're actually too cheap, because the weight, the process of making them and shipping them, and then X amount that don't get sold. There's a lot of waste in there. So there's no money in them.
The waste thing is interesting, because I was in South West in March, and I remember going shopping in Waterloo, and like, they had the racks of kind of like, I mean, the racks of new stuff, overpriced. There were secondhand racks. Mm. They'd been gone through already, you know. Yeah. There's some decent few things, but then they had the sales racks, right? And I found this, mm, fascinating. There was all the new vinyl that they cut, that they put the prices down on, and like, the amount of shit that was there was just incredible.
But you see, they don't. This is the problem, I think, with records now. They're not doing those mid-price ranges anymore. And if you remember, like, buying records in the 80s and 90s, you'd see that CBS Nice price. And that's gone, and I think that's where the fleece is kind of going on. And I think there's a feeling, like, in record labels, the major ones, like, oh, this is a fad, and let's just exploit it. Because they is, you're seeing Stevie Wonders, which have literally only a production cost, and they're €25, and you're like, there's no Nice price there. So
the Nice price is going to, there's a very interesting kind of like development, which, like, I mean, which is like, where I'm picking up new records really, mm, really cheaply is in fucking Tiger.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for 15 euros, yeah, you get the Stevie Wonder albums, you know, yeah, what I mean? Or in the States.
That's a label called Doll, and we stocked them too. And I was funny, because I started getting them. They're not the greatest titles.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, when I saw that, I was like, oh, Tiger, I'm surprised Tiger aren't stocking these. And then literally a couple of days later, someone came in, and I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense, yeah, that Tiger would stock them. But still, there still should be a way wider range of that. There's a lot, like, they do a lot of live records, and like, who wants to buy Fleetwood Mac live, you know? Give them the rumors and stuff, because they should only be €15. That's all that record should be. Mm. But I think it's weird that they have become this. They've kind of been fetishized, maybe. So people have, you know, just gone all.
Well, it's really interesting. Excuse me. In the States, there's a kind of a shop called Hardware Restoration or Pottery Barn. I can't remember which one it is. One of these kind of, like, it's a homeware shop, right? And they started, like, I mean, they got hold of the Capitol catalog, yeah, and they're selling the records.
Right.
And it's total fetish vibe. Yeah. It's like, you know, they're trying to pump out the kind of, like, I mean, the record players as well. You,
yeah,
know?
Yeah, I know.
And it's like, it's just, and you're kind of going, they don't. It's definitely not a music play. It's, yeah, definitely not a music play at all. It's, yeah, kind of like, it's homeware. It's kind of like, it's almost like home trends.
Yeah, you don't want to, like, you don't want to knock someone who buys a suitcase record player and a few records. That's grand. It's just when you see that they're being ripped off for them, or they're being told that actually this is a great way to listen to music, and then they don't realize that that sounds like way worse than listening to it on Spotify with a decent home system. So it is a bit of a shame. The only reason I think it's a shame is because that then they'll end up going, I don't want to buy records anymore, and they'll just kick the whole thing, you know, back to the way it was. But
and then we're in a situation where all these people who've bought kind of records, they're still shrink wraps, so they'll be going on to the second hand.
Well, that's it. They'll bring them all back to the shop. So that'll be a good thing. In 10 years' time, there's going to be a lot of very cheap Stevie Wonders knocking around, which is the way it should be.
Yeah.
You know, there should be a load of them second hand.
Right.
Like, I used to enjoy going to places to buy like a decent haul of second hands, but now you can't really do that because either A, people kind of have an inflated opinion of what they have, which is mostly the case, or B, it works out the same as getting in one of those kind of nice price, like the second tier titles.
Yeah.
So people want to buy a Stevie Wonder. They can't get Inner Visions for cheap, but they can get the one he did in 64, or not even, the little Stevie, which is good, but probably not what they're looking for.
Yeah, yeah. So in 10 years' time, when all these records are coming back into the racks, will All City still be there to take them in?
It will. It definitely will. I hope I'm not there, but it will be there. It will. And I'd say we have what have we got? All City, Freebird, Spin Dizzy, Tower, isn't that it? And Rage. Yeah, and that's enough for the city. So I would imagine if the shops like are still there, the only reason they won't be is that it's a very labour intensive business, in sense of, if you're trying to stock new records, keeping on top, as you know, of like everything, it takes a lot of time, and that would be the only reason.
Well, like, I mean, what are your overheads like? Because I'm curious about two things. Like, I mean, is the rental situation, is it manageable and controllable? And second of all, have you been affected by, like, I mean, say, like the change in footfall in the city centre? You're based in Temple Bar.
No, that's real sad, actually, because like even we're in Temple Bar since 2001, and when we came in, it was probably on the way down, but now it's horrendous around there. I mean, I think, and it was interesting hearing the guy talk before, like, just the world is just so corporate now that, you know, you can't really exist as an independent. You just get crushed, you know. So it's really like, I own the building that we're in.
Oh, you own it?
Yeah, right. Now I got lucky. And other than that, if I didn't, I'd say I would have the squeeze on me, and it would be tough. And I think that basically everything is getting chain stored. So you go around Temple Bar now, and there's very few independent establishments, very few. And the ones that are there are old. So anyone who wants to start something new is going to find it really tough. Yeah. And then you get to that stage where sometimes I'm walking around town, because I'm in town every day, and sometimes I wonder, and you're like, right, there's no one here. And then you realise, well, who works in town anymore? Yeah. You know, you're kind of, you know, maybe they're working in the M50, or they might be down the IFSC, which is a little bit further out. So, yeah, I think, I'm not sure how that's going to pan out. The city centres, like, are they just going to be like downtown in the States 20 years ago? Is that what's going to happen?
Jesus, like that'd be just horrific, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, like I suppose we're of an age where, like, I mean, the town provided that kind of centre where you went in, you had the adventures, you went to your bookshops, you went to your coffee shops, you went to your record shops.
Yeah.
You kind of like acquired your culture that way. But then again, like, I mean, like now we're in a situation where it's like, I mean, people acquire that culture online. They did learnings online.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, it's like, you know, as you're talking about, there will always be a generation of people who want the actual artifact, who want that experience, who want that community centre aspect.
There will, but it's the thing with also. City, I'm always amazed, and I always have to say this to the lads, like when that work there with me, like, you need to remember when someone comes into the shop that they mightn't be coming in for a month, because it's very difficult to get in and out of town now. And when we first started, there was that whole central bank thing, so you'd see mountains of kids on a Saturday afternoon, but now you walk around central bank and there's only a few of them. So maybe they're hanging around in Dundrum Shopping Centre or Blanche, or, you know, they're different spots that people probably are than they were 10 years ago. So that's probably just a general cultural change. There's more, I remember as a kid being bored a lot, you know, but I don't think kids necessarily would have that bored. There's a lot more things to do, you know, there's a lot more things to grab their money. You know, I think it was Noel Gallagher, someone told me, that said recently, you know, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you'd buy a record, now you buy three coffees. So, you know, there's that kind of thing. When you walk around town now, there's a lot more things to waste your money on.
A lot more coffee, you know?
There is a lot more coffee,
actually. It's better as well. Okay, yeah. So the record shop will be together in 10 years' time. What about the label?
The label will be too, yeah. I expect the label to get a bit stronger. Now I'm kind of figuring it out. So as long as everything doesn't go tits up, I figured it out in the sense of, like, I've made every mistake possible, and I now kind of understand a bit more about, you know, what you need to do to make sure you pay people, and not only that, make sure that they get what they want out of releasing a record with you. So it is a record label. It's a bit project managing in some ways,
yeah.
But also I understand now a bit about how to develop someone. Now, or at least, like, I haven't really managed to do it successfully, but at least I know that that's the end goal. So I think I want to give the label a bit more of a go.
I mean, are you still getting kids kind of like me approaching you, new producers approaching you? I mean, like, are you doing that kind of like the SoundCloud diving yourself?
A bit of both. It's if realistically, when you stop and think about how many good demos you get sent or how many demos you'd actually do something with, it's very few. So you have to go looking. Like, the problem is that you get sent tons of mail. I do try and listen to everything I get sent. Now, not in full, but you have to be careful about engaging in a conversation with someone of, like, oh, keep it up. Yeah, before you know it, they're at you every 5 minutes. And, of course, the less good they are, probably the more they're going to hit you up. And the good guys may be a bit quieter, a bit cooler, a bit more reserved. So the trick is, not the trick, because I'm not playing a trick, but you just have to have a good network.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a network of people, you hear about things.
Yeah.
And I think it was Richard Russell of XL, he said that, you know, he doesn't listen to any demos because he'll just know about it. And that's the one thing now, like, the hype goes quick. You know, people get hype very, very quick.
Completely, and that's really interesting kind of observation, because that applies right across the board. I remember last year interviewing your man Jack Garrett, he'd won the BBC Noise or Sound of 2016, and I remember his album's coming out, and he was going, I hope my album gets out before James Blake releases his album, because if James Blake releases his album, I'm fucked. Yeah. And I was thinking, that's really interesting. Then a couple of months later, James Blake released his album, and James Blake said, in the only interview he did support the album release, he said, well, I found out Beyonce was releasing her album the following week. I had to release my album before Beyonce. And I'm thinking, like, these are fucking superstars. Yeah. Like, I mean, but the noise goes fast.
Yeah.
Future Islands released an album a couple of weeks ago. Sure, it's gone already. I know. It's like, it just happens and it goes.
You've got like this tiny window. Now, on the flip side, if you get in, I think that basically now that brands don't sell things, like, people sell them. So what you're finding is, like, people are kind of resonating with people. So, say the Wino Boys, I don't know if they're on your radar at the minute, but they are blowing up. Now, obviously they're talented, but forgetting all that, but they're getting these endorsements from people. They're not even making the noise themselves. They're not hiring anything. Like, they don't even care, which feeds into it more. But when you get people saying you're good, rather than a press guy or rather than, you know, someone who you would know that's being paid to do it, even if he believes it. But when you get people randomly doing that's what sells the thing. So it's it can keep that kind of buzz going when maybe it mightn't happen otherwise. But it is unbelievable now how little mileage you will get out of a record. And I think it was a guy on Ninja Tune I was talking to recently, and their whole album campaign is now based around the two weeks release of the album. That's it.
Completely. And what they're doing as well, and it's fucking really weird. It's like they're not even promoting them the way they used to do. Years ago, you'd get the album like 2-3 months ahead of release. This time with the Bonobo release, they were only giving it to people like when you requested it, and like it was just like it was so tightly controlled because one, like, leaks thing is gone. If it leaks, it leaks.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, they knew that they need to make the biggest splash possible in a 3-week window.
Exactly. The people want that kind of element of surprise. Now, boom, the album's out. You get a couple of features, because there's so few places left to feature the stuff. everyone's chasing the same one. You try and get that, and then just hope that that kind of little wave just keeps people, either that they pre-order the thing on Bandcamp or wherever they buy it, or that they just play it on Spotify.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you try and get the guy on the road in the classic way and just keep his kind of name buzzing out there. But
Do you think that's kind of like sustainable? I mean, or will it change?
I'd say it will change because everything keeps changing, but I don't see how it's going to get anything other than less. You know, like it's going to like creep into like the one day around the album. Or I can't see, like the world's just so instant that I just can't see it going back to like anticipation and people waiting. What I've noticed with Honor actually, and funnily enough with the Kitzer thing we're doing, is you need to have constant product out there.
Yeah.
So that's what you do. You just have to like do these limited edition things, and then you try and do a t-shirt, and then you kind of try and create a buzz around that. And what is happening now is there's very few places, especially for small labels, which All City is very much one, to get featured, because all these blogs, they're all gone. So you're trying, the only way to do it is either get a couple of features on the main kind of RA type blogs, or get an organic buzz going on Facebook. So the only way to get any sort of organic buzz on Facebook is if people just happen to spend money on something that they like. So you have to constantly kind of, you know, it's not photos of your breakfast, because that doesn't work. It's like that guy, you have to have something of that guy's for sale.
But like it's so true what you're saying about the constant feed. I remember last year talking to Lyndon Stevens, he manages Kieran Laverick. And Kieran Laverick's released a couple of albums, really done really well on Spotify. He's played the Spotify game, he did the session with Spotify. Once you do a session with Spotify, they'll then kind of like seed your music and all their playlists. But I remember Lyndon kind of like saying to me, he had a release schedule in place for everything that basically Kieran was going to do, one new release a month for 12 months. Wow. Is a record day release, a version of kind of Bonnie Prince Billy's new partner, bam, that was there. A collaboration here, bam, that was there. A whole year of releases, and I've watched all year, the releases have all come out on schedule, and every single time it's just, I used to think it's about raising the profile, but no, it's not. It's like you just said, it's keeping him in
public
attention. It's
just keeping him in the feed. Like, it's kind of a bit grim, really, because it definitely wears people down. And I'm not sure that is necessarily sustainable, but it's definitely, I suppose, even when I was kind of growing up, the idea of being a musician or doing that stuff, it was not really a realistic thing. But I guess now you're facing worldwide competition. If you want to be in the music game, it's very feasible for some kid from Sligo. In fact, as I was saying to Aidan before, there's these Brame and Hamo guys. I don't know if you know them, but they're doing really well. So it's very, so now the competition is so intense that like you just have to kind of constantly be on your game, or that.
But like it's also an interesting thing. It's like, I mean, the fact that something can appear from anywhere. I ended up down a bizarre YouTube rabbit hole a couple of weeks ago. You know those lads from Ringer, from Rings End and Sandymount, Versatile,
They're good, aren't they?
So they're really good. The videos are great. Yeah. So I started, but then I kind of like discovered these grime kids called LDK from Sligo.
Right, okay.
It's fucking amazing. Yeah. But like, what was amazing was they. Yeah, I know, they're amazing. LDK are fucking great. But what was amazing was I looked at the YouTube count. It was over a million. Views. Yeah. So they're making some coin off that as
well.
Yeah, you know?
They should. Although YouTube's a funny one. It's difficult to get them to pay up.
But at the same time, it's like, I mean, the awareness factor is there. Yeah. It's not a fucking, it's not some stoner guy out in fucking Strand Hill refreshing the screen all the time to get that million.
No, there's
a genuine, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's a genuine connection with people. Like the Versatile, there's a genuine connection with kids of a certain age with those guys. They don't need like a label. There's nothing a label could do for them, you know? They need a promoter to come in
and put that show live. They could sell out Vicker Street in the morning,
big
no problem.
Time, yeah,
I've no doubt that someone like them, they could do 5,000, 6,000 in the Tree Arena by the end of the year.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Okay, definitely. Cool. But I suppose nowadays, there's no kind of promise of like, you know, here, and then by your third album, you're going to be in Croke Park. Like, that's all gone. But by the flip side, it's like you could easily be still making a living in music in your 40s and 50s. The idea that you're too old, that's gone. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of healthy, I think.
Okay. Last question for me, Nolan, because we covered an awful lot of ground. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us again at Banter. Last question. Like one of the themes we're kind of exploring here at Sure Shots this weekend is one of the discovery, you know. Oh, yeah. It's like, I mean, what we've discovered about ourselves. What have you discovered about Olin O'Brien from all the kind of like ducking and diving, jumping through the circles over the years? What have you discovered?
That's a good question. I don't really know. It's working with people. Like working in a shop is not something I wanted to do, and it's not something I particularly want to do. I just have ended up. So I suppose I've discovered, you know, I've discovered a kind of a bit about how to handle people that I didn't really know that I had in me. So, you know, I got a little bit better with that with age, maybe. So to be a bit nicer.
More of a people person.
Yeah, maybe. That's the only kind of thing. And there's other things I've discovered about music and stuff that I'm like, oh, I wish I knew that. On my way up, I had to make a phone call. There's a track we're putting out on a compilation coming, and someone texted me saying they were going to do a remix of it. It's an Irish thing. And I was like, how do they find this track? Like, we're about to reissue it. So I had to ring them and say, please don't remix that. And I just kind of thought, I said to them a couple of other things, and I just thought, geez, I wish like there had been someone around for me to ring 10 years ago when I was starting off, because that's the thing, like there's no mentorship in Irish music, and it's sadly lacking, and it's why, there's very few people can make a living off music other than say in the traditional kind of bands way. I'm sure that's tough, but outside of that, so that would be something I'd like to kind of help kind of the kids kind of just go, listen, don't do that, or there's a way to do this better, you know. So maybe that would be a nice little thing to be able
Excellent.
To do.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time, Olin O'Brien from Hull City. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks to Olin for joining us in Sligo, and thanks to Aidan, Shane and Al at Sure Shots for the invitation and all their help and hospitality. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news that we're up to with Banter, plus you can listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.